Fasten your seatbelts and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. On April 15, 1947, Jackie Robinson walked to his position at first base on Ebbets Field, crossing over the color barrier that had up until that point kept Major League Baseball lily white. Playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers, Jackie Robinson became the first African American to play Major League Baseball, making sports history and inspiring a generation of civil rights activism. Robinson's story of courage and resilience continues to inspire Americans of every age, race, and class. When young people learn Jackie Robinson's story, they learn the values of integrity, justice, determination, and teamwork. That is why Sharon Robinson, Jackie's daughter, has written numerous books for children and young adults about her father's experience. Today, we are going to hear from Sharon about her father's courageous decision to accept an offer from the Brooklyn Dodgers to become the first person of color in Major League Baseball. We will also hear about Jackie Robinson's influence in the civil rights movement and how his activism continued after his baseball career. I'm Jana Rose-Schleiss. Route 51's Glenn Moberg got a chance to talk with Sharon about her work and her father's legacy earlier this week. We will hear that interview on today's program, and after, I will talk with Connie Sexauer, UW Marathon County history professor and author of the forthcoming book, From a Park to a Stadium to a Little Piece of Heaven, and also Lee L. Willis, chair of the UW Stevens Point Department of History and International Studies. Sharon Robinson was in Central Wisconsin thanks to A Walk in Their Shoes, an organization that provides students and community members opportunities to engage with makers of modern history. She talked with multiple schools and shared her story with the community Tuesday night at the Grand Theater in Wausau. Now, we will hear Glenn talking with Sharon about her father's historic experience with Major League Baseball.
I'm fine with the fact that I've written a number of books about him because each age group, you know, there's different aspects of the story that will reach out to different age groups with kids. And so it's kind of cool to be able to reach second graders and fifth graders and high school students at the same time.
You wrote a book, Jackie's Nine, and you begin with this quote: "I was six when my dad retired from Major League Baseball and 12 when he was elected into baseball's Hall of Fame. I was 16 the first time my boyfriend hit me, 18 when my brother Jackie was arrested for drug possession, and 20 when I took control of my life. When I was 21, Jackie was killed in a car accident. My dad had a massive heart attack and died when I was 22. I'm no stranger to obstacles." Comment on that quote, if you could.
Well, Jackie's Nine is... was based off of the program that I do with Major League Baseball, and it's all about overcoming obstacles. So I feel like it's important for kids to understand that I'm asking them to write about, tell their story, and share their obstacles in life, and I want them to understand that my life also came with some serious obstacles.
You were 6 years old when your father, Jackie, retired from the major leagues. You grew up knowing, of course, that your father played baseball. But you tell a story in Stealing Home about being in summer camp, and the featured movie was the Jackie Robinson story, which not only was his story, but it featured him in the movie. Tell us about that experience, if you could, and what it was like to first learn of your father's significance through that Hollywood interpretation.
Well, prior to that, people would talk about my dad and his baseball playing, but they didn't talk about the trauma of the early year. So I really didn't understand that. My parents didn't talk about it. So being in this day camp where I was the only black kid once again and not being prepared for this film, so I didn't know it was coming, so I didn't know, there was no family discussion about it, and I'm seeing it really for the first time. I was shocked, and I didn't know what it said about my world because I'm living in an all-white neighborhood, all white schools, and I'm watching racism play out with, you know, and it's directed at my dad. And so it left me really confused, and so confused that I couldn't go home and say, well, what's up? Because I didn't even know how to phrase a question, or why didn't you tell me about this? Or I didn't know what to do with that information.
Yeah. In the movie, Branch Rickey, the Dodger general manager, the man who plays him, refers to Jackie Robinson as a boy. And he's referred to as a colored boy a couple of times in the movie. It's been criticized for that. Do you think that was
I should be criticized. I think there's so much about that film that should be criticized. It really makes me unhappy when somebody says, oh, I saw that film. I thought it was a great film. I'm like, no. You know, you have to think about a timing of this. That film was made in 1950. So if you were black and in films, you were in as a servant. And I just felt like I didn't recognize my dad, that they made him seem like a meek person, which I knew he wasn't. Where I love seeing my dad on the screen, I didn't get his voice. You know, it just everything about him made me feel like they had diminished him in some way.
And they seemed to sugarcoat some of the racism,
yes,
too.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, they did.
That famous meeting with Branch Rickey, when it was acted out in the movie, contains this quote: "Do you want a ball player who's afraid to fight back? I want a ball player with guts enough not to fight back." Mm-hmm. That was accurate.
Absolutely accurate and a true statement on character. So what he's looking for in Jackie Robinson is a stronger character, and I like that.
And he couldn't fight back, and your dad said that was torture.
Well, with fist or words. I always felt that he fought back as a player. Aggressive baseball playing, aggressive baseball, stealing of bases. I love when I see a footage of him when he knows he's got this. You know, he's stealing home and he jumps in the air and claps. You know, so he had ways of fighting back. What he once told me about the Black Cat incident. And
the Black Cat incident is where somebody from the opposing team threw a black cat on the field and said, here's your cousin. Or
Here's your cousin playing around. Hey, Jackie, here's your cousin playing around. And that was in Syracuse, New York. And it was a preseason game or something. It wasn't.
Not in the Deep South.
Yeah, but not in the Deep South. That's the point. And my dad, gets back at them as he's coming around third base and he's making it home, and he looks over and he says, I guess my cousin's happy now. So he had his sort of ways of fighting back, which I think were important. There was some way to release that anger and the frustration.
Jackie grew up in a family of sharecroppers in mm-hmm. Georgia, and it's the old cliche that black folks in post-Civil War America grew up picking cotton.
Mm-hmm. It was my grandmother's experience, and everything she knew was in farming. Not sharecropping, because her parents actually owned the land they lived on. When they came out of slavery, they had land. So they were not sharecroppers, but her Mally and her husband, Jerry, were sharecroppers.
And when they moved to Pasadena, we had a woman who was the head of the household, mm-hmm. who nonetheless acquired her own home.
Love it.
She was a little bit ahead of her time, wasn't she?
She was a feisty woman. Very strong. And I love the story of how she acquired it, because, you know, she moved into a white, you know, it was redlining back then, where they kept black families out, not by Jim Crow laws, but by cultural and word of mouth. And so she actually sent in a light-skinned cousin to purchase the house and then moved her brown-skinned family in to the neighborhood, you know. And so that's why they had the cross burnings and the...
Yeah, the neighbors were not exactly
they didn't
bring in the welcome wagon no. for them.
But she won them over. She said, "I'm not going, so you know, just deal with it."
It took a lot of courage at that.
Takes
period
a lot of
time.
Courage. Yeah.
Athletic skill must run in the family. Your
it does.
Uncle Mac, Jackie's brother, was an athlete alongside the famous Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. A lot was riding on him, mm-hmm. Representing America and African-American athletes. Did Mac's experience affect Jackie? It must have.
It did. When Mac came back from that, he couldn't get a job, and they were treated disrespectfully. And Mac ended up, you know, cleaning streets, and was always very frustrated and angry over that. So I think that also affected my dad.
And he came in second, Right behind Jesse Owens.
Tenths of seconds below, behind him.
And he finds himself cleaning streets.
Mm-hmm. And that's a silver medal.
And Jackie was quite an athlete. He excelled at track, the broad jump, and also in football and basketball at UCLA. He could have done anything.
Well, it's always funny because kids always assume that his best sport was baseball in college, and it was his worst sport. He batted just over 1 point something or other, you know, and he didn't really learn baseball until he went to the Negro Leagues.
And he ended up being drafted when he left UCLA, and he found himself even fighting for civil rights when he was in the service. Can you share a story about that?
Okay, so he meets Joe Lewis in the Army, and Joe Lewis has power and influence, and he's working with the Army to allow blacks into Officers Candidate School, and my dad actually gets in to Officers Candidate School because of the work of Joe Lewis. So he's a second lieutenant. He has been kept out of Europe because a knee injury. He's on his way. He gets on a bus heading into town to go to the hospital because they were going to, you know, re-examine this knee and see what was going on. He gets on the bus, spots a woman he knows who's very light-skinned, and he sits down next to her, and she's like in the middle of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
The bus driver assumes he's broken two rules, or at least one law and one rule, and that is black men do not talk to white women, and two, he got on the bus and didn't go to a Jim Crow bus and didn't go to the back of the bus. So my father refused. They get into an argument, he and the bus driver, and the bus driver pulls up next to the MP's stand and says, "Arrest this man." So my dad knew his rights, and they had changed – again, Joe Lewis had been instrumental in this. They had changed the ruling that a Jim Crow bus on an Army base, you did not have to follow Jim Crow laws. So therefore, he didn't have to go to the back of the bus.
He knew his rights.
He knew his rights. They then proceeded to charge him and decided to go on insubordination, which is technically – either way you looked at it, it was still going to be insubordination. He didn't follow their rules. And so Dad, in their defense, one of the things they said is, well, you took the word of a private over a second lieutenant. Therefore, I was also treated unfairly. So anyway, he ends up winning that case and then asked to be discharged from the Army.
And he ended up getting into baseball, but in the Negro Leagues with the Kansas City Monarchs. And he demanded that he be treated with respect, and the team did. You know, if they would pull into a diner somewhere and that diner wouldn't let them wash their hands, they'd move on without filling up the bus.
Yeah, Buck O'Neill was a famous quote, a story from Buck O'Neill of them pulling into a gas station and, you know, my father's getting off the bus to go wash his hands, and the guy says, "You can't use the bathroom." He said, "Well, then take the hose out of the tank." You know, it was – my father had a different experience from many of the Negro Leaguers, and he knew – and he was a fighter early on against the inequality, and he just felt that part of the Negro Leagues was not equal.
And the thing that's interesting, Sharon, is that a lot of people don't realize that your father was fighting for civil rights long before he even stepped onto Ebbets Field.
He was. From his childhood and his teenage years and his own, you know, own personal battles.
Talk about the threats of violence that he received after he finally got hired by the Dodgers. There was a situation where the three travelers, they called themselves, and they sent a letter threatening to kill him if he was to step out onto the field.
Right. And the team's response was, "We will all dress up as Jackie Robinson." It was sort of a funny thing. They will all dress up as Jackie Robinson, and they won't know who to shoot.
So they could right. Put the number 42
right.
on their uniform.
I mean, obviously they can't really. It would still be distinguished
unless they wanted to put blackface on.
Right?
Or something.
No, it was more of a moment of support from the team. I actually showed the kids today that letter in the assembly.
And that must have really boosted the morale of your father at the time to see
Absolutely.
That the team was behind him.
Absolutely did. That, you know, it took some time for them to get to that point, but he really, it showed that he had become a teammate.
And your parents' relationship mm-hmm. was really special. They were really partners in, you know, both at home and taking on the world in this role that Jackie had. Michelle Obama said in the documentary that Ken Burns made about your father, "I don't think we would have had Jackie Robinson without Rachel."
Yeah, it was a funny moment in that because she was also thinking about she and Barack, you know, the importance of women or importance of that part or their of a strong, solid partnership. That's absolutely true. They worked well as a team. Things one of the kids asked me today, you know, did he come home angry? And I said, well, you know, when he my mother did not travel with him. It was when he was doing away games, but on home games she went, and they had an agreement that they would debrief on the way home, so he didn't bring home the anger.
But she sat in those home games, and she had to hear the jeers of the
she
crowd
did.
and the people shouting the racial slurs
she
at him.
She certainly did, yes. And she, you know, she's a strong woman who had not faced racism until she entered in this experience with my dad. You know, the traveling down south, the Jim Crow laws, all of that was new. And the hardest part for her was how they attempted to demoralize, you know, her husband, and she sort of had no way to fight back on that.
And he couldn't fight back, at least not in terms of taunts, not in terms of physical reaction. If somebody spiked him, if there were these racial slurs being hurled at him, he had to just bite his lip, and he said this was torture.
Yeah, it was. It was torture. But it was an agreement for the. I think it would have been real torture if he. It was a long term thing. But he knew it was time limited. So they agreed in the first 2 to 3 years. And actually, Branch Rickey released him after 2 years. And so that's why I think 1949 was his best season. That's when he got the most valuable player, because he's now himself and can not feel the tied up, you know, mm-hmm. tightness, the tension of holding back.
And he broke the color barrier in 1947, mm-hmm. and just for reference, that was 7 years before Brown versus the Board of Education, 7 years before the integration of schools. How different would the civil rights era have been, do you think, if your dad hadn't integrated Major League Baseball when he did?
It could have delayed some of the movement. You had individual achievements, you know, the fight with Joe Louis and Max Smelling, which had, you know, given this again strengthened the resolve to do something.
But baseball plays a special role in
America. It plays
America's
a special
pastime.
Role, America's pastime. It was America. It spoke to. I mean, that's why they chose baseball. Sports writers put the pressure on baseball initially, because, you know, football was also segregated, so was basketball. But this was American pastime. This was supposed to be democracy, and yet they were restricting who was allowed to enter based on color.
Sharon Robinson talking about her father, Jackie Robinson's, experience as the first man of color to play in Major League Baseball. I'm Jana Rose Schleiss. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Route 51's Glenn Moberg will pick up the story with Sharon as she talks about Jackie's involvement with the civil rights movement.
Life is a ball game.
If I had a room jammed with trophies, awards, and citations, and a child of mine came into that room and asked what I had done in defense of black people and decent whites fighting for freedom, and if I had to tell that child I had kept quiet, that I had been timid, I would have to mark myself a total failure in the whole business of living. Jackie Robinson.
Today on Route 51, we're listening to Sharon Robinson talk about her father, Jackie Robinson's, experience as the first man of color to play Major League Baseball. I'm Jana Roche-Lice. Sharon was in Central Wisconsin thanks to the A Walk in Their Shoes school history program. Now, Route 51's Glenn Moberg continues his interview with Sharon as they talk about Jackie's involvement in the civil rights movement.
It was in 1962 when my father was elected to the Hall of Fame. Dr. King calls my dad and says, I want to do a fundraiser for you in New York City. And do a fundraiser in response to your being elected to the Hall of Fame. So that was their first time working together from that.
And the fundraiser would help the civil rights struggle.
It was for SCLC, correct.
Leadership Conference.
Yes. My dad ended up heading a fundraiser for burned out churches because he goes with King to Albany, Georgia, and for a voter registration drive. When they arrive, two churches are bombed that day. They had their first jazz concert at our home in June of 1963. Then we go as a family to the March on Washington, and my father agrees and mother agreed to do another jazz concert at our home, and Dr. King said he would attend this one.
Who were some of the musicians at that concert?
Oh, my God. We had Dizzy Gillespie and
Count Basie.
Dave Brubeck. Dave
Brubeck.
And here I go with names.
You were tied up at an early age into the civil rights movement. You got a front row seat in the March of Washington.
Absolutely.
Martin Luther King's famous speech. What was that like?
Well, you know, it was so exciting and so a little bit scary to actually now I've been asking to go on marches and now we're actually there. Very hot, very crowded, and I fainted. You know, I don't think we knew how important that speech was at the moment, but we just knew we had witnessed something and we didn't quite have the words for it.
Jackie stayed active in civil rights and politics after his retirement. And something that I found interesting is that he refused to commit to one political party. He campaigned for Nixon over Kennedy in 1960 because of Kennedy's spotty record on civil rights. What did you think about that as a young girl?
Oh, I was very, very upset by it. I was 10. It was my first time getting involved in politics, and it was because of my fifth grade teacher. And I said to my dad, the teacher sent us home to – remember, this is
1960.
So my teacher sent us, his students, home to find out who their father was voting for in the election. And I, of course, knew my father was going for Nixon. So I went home. I was like, Dad, can I say that you're supporting Kennedy? Please. I just cannot sit on the side with Nixon. And I'm already different in this school. Please just do this for me. And that's when I got my first lecture on, you know, when you meet with somebody and they don't look you in the eye, you can't trust them, and he didn't have a good record.
Kennedy didn't look Jackie Robinson in the eye.
Right. And he couldn't really face, you know, the fact that he didn't have this strong record. And then it came down to Dr. King being jailed. And my dad was an advisor to Nixon, and he went to Nixon and said, listen, you have to go to the jail. And Nixon refused, and Kennedy went. And that's when the tide shifted in terms of the black community.
Kennedy made that famous phone call to King's wife.
Yes.
And then in 1964, he campaigned for another Republican, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller.
Oh, he was a Rockefeller.
Liberal Republican.
Yeah.
And then when conservative Barry Goldwater won the nomination, your dad refused to support him and threw his support to Lyndon Johnson.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yeah, it was fun because we actually were at the Republican convention. I wasn't actually in the convention, but we went as a family. And on the way back, we drove back. And on the way back, we stopped off at Rockefeller's ranch so the two men could sit on the front porch and debrief, you know, like over the change in the Republican Party. And it shift to this conservative, you know, looking like they might go to supporting Goldwater.
You write in Stealing Home that you were a freshman in high school when your cousin told your father that he was an Uncle Tom.
Arrogant cousin.
Yeah, you went to your father to try to learn why your cousin said that. Can you talk about that?
Well, I didn't really understand what that meant. And it was during a time when my dad was, he was clearly involved in the civil rights movement when it was King and NAACP.
And here it's the late 60s and things are getting
now
militant.
It's very – it's the militancy. And my dad did not support the militancy. He told me that, you know, the black community is not going to take up arms. And you know, so this is – it's crazy. We're, you know, we can't go down that route. It's not going to work. That's not the way to go.
When you got a little bit older,
yes,
and you were in your late teens, mm-hmm, you had an infatuation with the Black Panthers for a little while, and,
yeah,
and got a poster of H. Rapp Brown.
Huey Newton. Yes, it was a beautiful poster. He was our king. And I went and got a fake leather black jacket. I was like, you know.
Yeah, so you hung that poster of Huey Newton. He had like an assault rifle in the.
Did
hung it up in your room and
yes,
and how'd
across
your dad,
my day guys
how'd your dad react
girls
to that?
Oh, my dad came in home and I was in college then, and he walked in my room and we're just chatting. He looks over and sees that poster. He's like, "Get that off your wall." My dad, you know, rarely did my father go, you know, authoritarian with me, so it was like, "Why?" And you know, so he explained why, and I took it off because I was in his house.
You know, I get the feeling that your dad kind of was struggling with a lot of things in the late 60s and the change. You know, all of America was struggling at the time. He criticized Malcolm X.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he thought the NAACP, which he'd supported for all those years, too conservative.
Too conservative, yeah. No, it was a troubling time. You didn't really know what direction the movement was going to go in. Or, you know, we had the war in Vietnam and even was at odds with Martin Luther King over, you know, whether we should pull out, and he has a son that's been to Vietnam and come back very troubled from Vietnam. So he's got very mixed feelings about that.
And you had problems with Jackie Jr.
Yes.
You ended up getting involved in drugs and then cleaning up his act and dying tragically at an early age.
Yeah, well, Jackie had troubles from I won't say probably junior high. You know, I had learning problems and dropped out of school a couple of times.
Do you think that had anything to do with him having the name Jackie Robinson Jr.?
I think it had a lot to do with it.
One of your children's books is called Testing the Ice,
mm-hmm,
and it's the story of your father venturing out onto a pond near your family's country home, mm-hmm, to test the ice, tapping it with a broom, taking steps further out into the lake, tapping it again. At the end of the novel, this little children's book, you learn that your father couldn't swim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a metaphor for the way he raised you kids.
It certainly was. And, you know, kids often ask me what's my favorite memory, and that is one of my favorite memories because it happened all of the time, all throughout the winter. And it was a testament to his courage as well, you know, being willing to step out there alone, making sure it was safe for his kids and for the neighbors.
Your father threw out the first pitch at the 1972 World Series.
Mm-hmm.
That was 25 years after he broke the color barrier and mm-hmm, shortly before his death.
Mm-hmm.
And he used the opportunity that day to chide Major League Baseball for not having any managers or coaches.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that black people were good enough to be athletes, but they weren't good enough to use their brains to manage the team.
Correct. It was a very, for many reasons, and partly we knew how sick he was, that was just a really amazing trip and a chance for Dad to he didn't believe in just celebrating or getting awards. He really believed in using his celebrity to make change, and that was the, you know, kind of at that point that was the change he needed to see.
You work for the Office of the Commissioner of Baseball as Director of Educational Programming, where you created the Breaking Barriers program in sports. Tell us a little bit about that.
Today we're, you know, it's our almost 22nd year, and we've reached, you know, 34 million kids, and it's really been a great program. So we get essays for the kids after they do the program. They testify via an essay contest.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get, you know, 17,000 essays from kids all over the country. And then the winners, I'll go out and visit them in their schools and bring them their laptops and their prizes. And then we bring some to their ballpark and two the two top prizes. One will come to the World Series and one will come to the All-Star Game. So it's really an incredible program, and I love it.
The Jackie's work goes on.
His work goes on in a way that these kids today can grab onto.
Your father was an incredible athlete. He could run faster and do more things than anybody in baseball. But he died so young of a massive heart attack complicated by diabetes. You had to watch him struggle with declining health. You know, it's kind of a cliche that the good die young. We lost Martin Luther King, Jack Kennedy, Robert Kennedy. We lost Jackie early, not to an assassin's bullet, but still we lost him early. But he made such a difference when he was alive.
Yeah, it just reminds us that none of us know how long life is going to be, and we just have to make use of every day. And I think my dad did that with his life.
The Ken Burns PBS documentary on your dad quotes Martin Luther King Jr. Jackie Robinson was a sitter before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom rides. How do you think Martin Luther King would view America today?
Oh, I'm not even going to try to answer that. I really don't like those kind of, you know, how my dad would feel or how Martin, that's just too big of a thing for me because I know how I feel about it, but I can't speak, I don't feel like I can speak for them. From my perspective, the world has become more complicated and complex and the problems are as well, yet they are so much, so similar. You know, at March 24th, we'll have a children's march that was inspired by the 1963 Children's March in Birmingham, Alabama. You know, we have to really understand history. And so as it begins to circle back around, we jump right in there and say, hey, we've already been here, and we're just not going to tolerate this. So we see that with the women's movement, with the Me Too movement, whatever it is. You know, we say, oh, nope, not doing it again. And I think that's very exciting.
The documentary also quotes former President Barack Obama. Jackie Robinson, he said, laid the foundation for America to see its black citizens as subjects and not just objects. It meant that there were 6-, 7-, and 8-year-old boys who suddenly thought that a black man was a hero. Well, we've gone from the presidency of Barack Obama to the presidency of Donald Trump. What does that say about this country?
It's very troubling. There's a lot of backsliding, and our leader is at the helm of that. So it's we've got a lot of work to do, and we have to stand up and still move forward and don't allow, you know, and fight back. That's what it says to me. You know, we have to keep fighting back.
I want to kind of wrap things up with one more quote from your dad's autobiography. I never had it made. Jackie Robinson wrote, "A life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives. Everything I got," he said, "I fought hard for, and Rachel fought by my side. But I know that I haven't got the right to say truthfully that I have it made. I cannot possibly believe I have it made while so many of my black brothers and sisters are hungry, inadequately housed, insufficiently clothed, denied their dignity as they live in slums or barely exist on welfare. I cannot say I have it made while our country drives full speed ahead, speeding along a course toward more and more racism." He wrote that in 1972. He could have written it today.
It really is prolific.
I'm not going to ask you what Jackie would think about the world we live in today, because he said you don't like those questions. But I would ask you, what do you think he would be telling young people today about the role that they need to play in building a new future for America?
I think he would talking to them about their voice and being heard, and they have a role to play. And in addition to getting educated, they have to care about the communities they're living in. And I think we're seeing that, again, with these kids. My concern is that the focus only be on school violence when violence is so rampant in our communities. And I don't want it to be narrowed down to just these, you know, recent or, you know, these traumatic school events when we have to look at violence in general and,
well, I mean, you
and
can
the role
talk about,
of guns play. Yeah.
You can talk about school shootings. Mm. You can arm teachers. Mm. But if you arm teachers, is that going to save the 57 people who were shot in Las Vegas and the 851 who were injured?
No. Or the children that have been killed in by police. I mean, there's all kinds of ways we have violence, and the violence against peer-to-peer violence. So no, that is not the answer. I do not believe that is the answer. You know, I'm sure my dad would feel the same way, you know, that the violence cannot be met with more violence. That's not the answer to this.
Sharon, is there anything you'd like to add?
You know, just that it's been an incredible visit to Central Wisconsin. I am certainly out of my element, but not really, because it reminds me a lot of where we live in Connecticut. I mean, we live in a farming community in Connecticut. So actually, it's not that different. And I've always been around, you know, in predominantly white communities. But the response has just been extraordinary from these children. They ask good questions. They are very excited that I'm there. They want to understand. They do understand the similarities between some of the things that are happening today. And it's just been really insightful and inspiring for me as well.
It's been inspiring for us. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
That was Sharon Robinson talking to Route 51's Glenn Moberg about her father, Jackie Robinson's, experience as the first man of color to play Major League Baseball. I'm Jana Rochelais. We're going to take a short break. When we return, I'll be joined by Connie Sexauer, UW Marathon County History Professor, and Lee L. Willis, Chair of the UW Stevens Point Department of History and International Studies.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh.
Today on Route 51, we heard Sharon Robinson talk about her father, Jackie Robinson's, experience as the first man of color to play Major League Baseball. I'm Jana Rochelais. Sharon was in Central Wisconsin thanks to the A Walk in Their Shoes School History Program. For some perspective and analysis, I'm joined now by our guests, Connie Sexauer, UW Marathon County History Professor, and Lee L. Willis, Chair of the UW Stevens Point Department of History and International Studies. Thank you both for being here today. Lee, Lee, I'm going to start with you.
Sure.
Jackie Robinson starts his Major League Baseball career in 1947. What did the Civil Rights Movement look like at that time? Did one exist, and were there any successes?
One definitely did exist. The NAACP had been fighting segregation for quite some time, and had a cadre of lawyers who had been challenging the idea of separate but equal, that the Supreme Court had declared segregation as constitutional in that Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896, and they had been trying to undermine segregation through a series of lawsuits and taking a litigative strategy, and they'd had some success, and particularly in the integration of graduate schools by the 1940s. And also in 1947, the Truman administration, and under the direction of President Truman, had established a civil rights commission to investigate discrimination in American life. And that year in 1947, Harry Truman had, through executive order, declared to integrate the armed forces. And so there definitely were sort of larger, you know, contexts and movements afoot in the 1940s as Jackie Robinson was integrating baseball.
Jackie Robinson's mother had to jump through some hoops to purchase their home, which was located in an all-white neighborhood. And the difficulties didn't stop there. Jackie and his siblings dealt with discrimination and outright hatred growing up, cross-burnings in their front yard, adults in the neighborhood verbally berating them. We associate those actions with the Deep South. However, they lived in California. What was life like for African Americans all over the country in the 1940s and 50s?
Well, yeah, I think that's one of the most important details of the Jackie Robinson story, in addition to integrating baseball, is that it offers an opportunity to talk about the issue of redlining and discrimination in housing that was accomplished through restrictive covenants. As America was suburbanizing in the mid-20th century, a lot of those suburbs tried to keep blacks out, and this was definitely a phenomenon that happened out west. It happened here in the Midwest. A lot of small communities in Wisconsin had restrictive covenants in neighborhoods. And if you go back and you do title searches and you look at the property records of individual subdivisions, you will see that many of them had these restrictive covenants that forbade homeowners from selling or renting to non-white persons. And so that was a very, very common issue. And one of the goals of the civil rights movement after, integration of the armed forces and of schools and so forth was to end discrimination in housing. And that was a major focal point of the civil rights movement in Milwaukee. We're looking at the 50th anniversary of those marches. So it was a very common experience. And I think that's something that we have to reckon with today that's oftentimes forgotten when we remember the civil rights movement.
Certainly. Connie, the St. Louis Cardinals are your area of expertise. Branch Rickey managed the Cardinals for 23 years before he came to the Brooklyn Dodgers. Tell us a little bit about the man and why did he want to start what he called the noble experiment of integrating baseball?
He was a very Christian man, a Methodist, and in fact did not come to the ballpark or participate in games on Sundays. Mm-hmm. And his drive was to open up baseball mainly to youth and the younger players. He, of course, was part of the team in World War II when so many of the players went to fight in the war. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in my research that I've ever seen anything where he brought up integration when he was in the Cardinal organization. But once you know who the man is and his sincerity and his opportunity for all and equality, it doesn't surprise you that this is somebody that would be on the cutting edge of this topic.
He famously tested Jackie Robinson to see if he could take the heat he would receive being the only African-American player in an all-white league. Branch Rickey understood that if Jackie ever hit back or stood up for himself, that that would be the story. It would be reported that the black man was causing trouble. The fact that he was being tormented wouldn't be mentioned. Integration would then be seen as a failure and less likely to expand to other arenas. This plan was high risk, high reward. Why was Branch Rickey so committed to getting those rewards?
I can't really speak for the man himself, but I would say Christian values and the opportunity that it's time. It was interesting, right after World War II is when he but others started to say, if black men can fight and die for our country, they should have other opportunities. So I also think that when he set Jackie up for all of what he was going to face, that he was testing him to make sure he was prepared and wouldn't blow the whole thing out of the water. And I think he took him under his wing. The one thing when Sharon talked about referring to him as boy, mm-hmm. I certainly think that that was not a racial slur to Jackie or to any blacks. I don't think that it certainly was at the time, but I don't think that was Branch Rickey's interpretation. Branch was older. He brought that farm system to the St. Louis Cardinals, the first to have the minor leagues. And to him, the boys were the ones that were going to win. Mm-hmm. So I can certainly see where it's a sensitive subject and a sensitive word, but I don't think that that was his interpretation of it.
For sure. Your forthcoming book is called From a Park to a Stadium to a Little Piece of Heaven, and it's about the cultural changes through the space and place of American baseball parks. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, it starts in 1883 when the Cardinals are not even a National League team, and examines what it was like in those days to attend a baseball game. And I love it. There's a picture that is available in the archives that shows the first park called Sportsman's Park, which is at Grand and Dodier in St. Louis. And it shows just a regular baseball diamond like we'd have today in a regular little mm-hmm. county park, and two grandstands, and then people would pull up in their horse and buggies and sit and watch the game.
Wow.
And the innocence of what that was. The inexpensive to attend the games, and I'm sure if you wanted to, you probably didn't have to pay admission if it's that open.
Mm-hmm.
But to what it is today, you know, a huge mega business, capitalism captured. And it follows how culture has changed, business practices as well as society itself.
Wow. Truly is America's pastime. Lee, we heard Glenn ask Sharon how different the civil rights movement would have been if we hadn't had Jackie Robinson integrate baseball in 1947. I'd like you to respond to that as well.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. You know, like as I said earlier, there was already a much larger structural response to segregation and also other issues like disfranchisement. But I think the images of Jackie Robinson playing baseball in what had been a whites-only league, I think that inspired, you know, the rising generation of civil rights workers in the 50s and 60s who were encouraged by and were, you know, given courage by his bravery in integrating baseball and to take on things like sit-ins and going down to Mississippi for Freedom Summer to you know, risk their lives. And so I think that's a big part of his story. And also I think helping white Americans come to terms with the reality that this was the way we were going to guarantee or move toward freedom and equality in the United States. So I think it was symbolic, but also it had a real practical consequence.
Sure. After Jackie Robinson retires, he is a baseball legend, and he starts to use his prominence to help the civil rights movement. By giving speeches, he traveled to the South several times, and the Robinson family hosted many jazz concerts to raise bail money for jailed marchers. Lee, what do you think Jackie's influence was on the civil rights movement?
Well, you know, I think, yeah, he continued to, I mean, he could have retired and you know, retreated from public life. He certainly made his contribution. But, you know, by, you know, continuing to stick his neck out in what was still a very unpopular position nationally, I think we tend to forget how much negativity civil rights workers received. I mean, today we lionize people like Martin Luther King, but they were targeted, despised people by large sections of the population. And so mm-hmm. for his family to continue to support this movement, you know, was huge. And I think it was a shot in the arm for civil rights workers to have someone like Jackie Robinson still in their corner fighting for them, raising money for the cause.
And the civil rights movement of the 60s is often presented as Martin Luther King Jr. and the NAACP versus Malcolm X and the Black Panthers. Jackie Robinson was sort of tangled up in that as well and struggled with those disagreements. Is that an accurate representation of the movement, or was it more nuanced than that?
It was definitely more nuanced than that. I mean, I think that the perception of the civil rights movement as this, you know, we use this singular noun, movement, it implies that it's this singular, coordinated move toward action. And it actually was always a coalition of different kinds of groups with different types of strategies. And in the 60s, a lot of the initial goals of the civil rights movement in terms of establishing a stronger Civil Rights Act, establishing a Voting Rights Act. A lot of those goals were achieved, and those coalitions like the NAACP, which was taking a litigative strategy, like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was taking more of a direct action strategy through organizing things like boycotts.
Sure.
To students. You have those groups kind of splintering by 65 and 66 and trying to figure out where to go next.
Sure. Thanks, yeah. Lee. We're gonna cut you off there as I can give Connie the last question.
Sure.
In 1972, shortly before his death, Jackie Robinson threw out the first pitch at the World Series. And even on that day, 25 years after he broke the color barrier in the league, he used the platform to push for greater integration and equality. Connie, where are we today in Major League Baseball, and what do you think Jackie Robinson would say about the state of the league?
Well, it's an interesting place where we are today. We don't have as many African-Americans playing baseball as we did, and investigations need to be looked into the reasons why.
Sure. We are all out of time. Thank you so much. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you, Jenna.
Thank you.
I'm Jana Roche-Lace. We want to thank today's guests, Connie Sexauer, UW-Marathon County History Professor and author of the forthcoming book, From a Park to a Stadium to a Little Piece of Heaven. Lee L. Willis, Chair of the UW-Stevens Point Department of History and International Studies. And Sharon Robinson, author, educator, and daughter of baseball legend Jackie Robinson, who talked with Glenn Moberg earlier this week. We'd also like to thank Colin Hansen of Edgar Elementary School and a Walk in Their Shoes school history program for making this possible. You can find out more about Sharon Robinson and her work at SharonRobinsonInc.com. Thanks to our executive producer and on-air producer, Rick Ryer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Count Basie, Winona Carr, Sam Cooke, John Legend, and Mark Isham. Special thanks to Ken Burns for clips from his film, Jackie Robinson. Next week on Route 51, we discuss a new teen movement in Marathon County. If you missed part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety at 7 p.m. Friday on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. You can download it at wpr.org/route51. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. Until next week, we're heading out of town.